From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Today, part two of our conversation with media mogul Barry Diller. For nearly the past decade, Diller has backed award-winning movies and Broadway shows from now embattled mega-producer Scott Rudin. Asked about allegations that Rudin engaged in a decades-long pattern of abusive behavior, Diller pushes back.
If in fact it is true that he was abusive to people in his office, I never participated in it. I do not condone it. And if it was true, I would hope that he would find a way, as has been suggested, to deal with that and re-enter the business because he's too valuable a resource to not be in the business unless his behavior in the future would be heinous.
Barry Diller emotionally defends longtime associate Scott Rudin and decries cancel culture. But first, a busy news week and an extra big banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Scarlett Johansson, she has sued the Walt Disney Company. This is a big battle, a big star in a big war. She is suing because her movie, Black Widow, she says she was promised exclusive theatrical release. Disney changed that plan, as you know, and we all know. They put it on Disney Plus the same day that it opened in theaters for a $30 upcharge. They then proceeded to brag about how much money it made in its first weekend, $60 million, which is not normal, but maybe they shouldn't have done that. I don't know. They've been trying to keep that kind of information secret. She says that this decision cost her $50 million.
Yeah, this is a big deal because it goes to this question of what is the priority of these studios? They have contracts with their big talent for movies like these summer movies that give them box office bonuses at certain thresholds. If you hit $500 million, you get X. If you hit $600, you get Y. And the point of the company right now is to grow its streaming services. You mentioned that they put out a press release about how much people watched on Disney Plus. The stock went up 4% that day. And it's very interesting. In this lawsuit, Scarlett Johansson alleges that Disney is 100% focused on that stock price to the detriment of its talent partners. And that's the basis of this lawsuit. She wants to be paid as if this were a big box office hit, which it likely would have been if it wasn't on Disney Plus simultaneously.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's some discussion about what is the pandemic and what is the availability of the thing on streaming. But, you know, I think it's kind of obvious. A big movie like this gets repeat viewers. But if you can go watch it on the big screen and then watch it for free at home or watch it for 30 bucks at home, that may make sense depending on how many people there are in your household. Repeat viewing, I think, obviously goes away. And the thing did fall off a cliff in the second weekend, which is not normal for Marvel movies.
It was also heavily pirated, which happens when these movies go on these streaming services.
Yeah, it's been another concern. So I think this is in part a function of the way Disney is now structured, where the business side dictates a lot of terms to the creative side and says, you know, this is where your project is going to go. Our guest today, Barry Diller, talked about this last week, but it does create a disconnect between the people who have to work with the talent and the people who are trying to make the streaming service the be-all and end-all and save a lot of money. And this creates tension. You know, we saw a sort of a different, but not that different version of this when Warner Media put its entire 2021 slate on its HBO Max, its service, for free. But, you know, there was a huge outcry and they had to write really big checks. They had to give people the benefit of the doubt. And even movies that probably wouldn't have done that well and certainly were no Black Widow, those people got large checks because they were put in a position of having to make up, you know, for having blindsided their talent partners. Disney has been known, and you have written this, to play real hardball with these deals. And I have to think that it's not an accident that the first one, you know, really doing the high profile attack here is a huge star in a huge movie with what seems to be a pretty compelling case.
Yeah, it's no coincidence that Scarlett Johansson is the one to sue here because she's at the end of her Marvel contract and, you know, she's in a different place where she has this power as a big star who's not tied to Disney or Marvel. We'll see if others follow in her footsteps, but I want to talk a little bit about some of the allegations in the complaint. There's a very specific email that is referenced from a Marvel Studios lawyer to Johansson's representatives where he says, we know this is a big part of your compensation, these box office bonuses. If we make any change to the release schedule, we will absolutely come back to you and discuss this going forward. So they're pointing to this as proof that Marvel agreed this was a wide theatrical release and that this is a breach of that agreement to unilaterally decide to put it on Disney Plus. It's an interesting argument. I think Disney would argue that a wide theatrical release doesn't necessarily mean an exclusive wide theatrical release. But as we know, all the previous Marvel movies have had that exclusive window, and that's going to be a key point here.
Well, and they're saying this was supposed to be a traditional theatrical model, and we know what that is. I have to think that there is some kind of legacy executives, people who grew up in more traditional Hollywood, who are thinking, you know, this kind of thing serves you right. But as I said before, I think this is a beginning of a battle that was going to have to be fought, because you can't just move everything to streaming and not be transparent and tell people, here's the money. I mean, if you're Netflix, you can, because everybody knows what the deal is with Netflix. But if you're Disney or Warner Media, you actually, that can't work. And what we're going to look at going forward is this fight, and we'll see how it goes. Let me turn to NBC and the Olympics, or I should say NBC Universal and the Olympics. We talked before about the risk that the Olympics were taking with the high COVID rates in Japan, a low vaccination rate, high elderly population. Boy, it just seems a bit snake bitten right now, because many things that could go wrong did. It's not really shocking that the ratings from linear TV, from, you know, watching TV on your cable, through your cable service, whatever, have fallen really sharply. But nonetheless, that is not necessarily what NBC Universal had in mind when they paid a big number for these Olympics. There is talk that some advertisers are going to want what they call make goods, which is free advertising to make up for the audience that wasn't delivered when their ads ran during the Olympics. One of the other things that's being much discussed is this frustration. You know, this was supposed to be a big boost for Peacock. Everybody kept talking about that. And I think a lot of people thought, oh, well, I'll get Peacock and I can watch everything. And that is very far from the truth. It's sort of chopped up what you can watch where. And we're hearing a lot of consumer frustration with that.
Yeah, people are very upset about that. And they're also controlling how the clips are distributed on social media, which is further driving people towards the NBC-owned channels. But it's also frustrating people. You know, Jeff Shell, the CEO of NBC Universal, said that the Olympics will still be profitable for them. But even he's acknowledging that everything is just aligned against them, from the lack of fans in the stands to the, you know, the COVID protocols and everything preventing the coverage from being as robust as it usually is, to the fact that Simone Biles, the biggest star of these Olympics, has, at least for the first week, has bowed out of some major competitions. You know, this is, everything is aligned. And as we've said on the show previously, the whole point from the corporate perspective of NBC Universal was to drive people to Peacock. And the fact that that Peacock experience is not a great one for many people who are testing it out for the first time is really disappointing for this company.
Yeah, Joe Adalian at Vulture wrote a real deep dive on this, and he made some really good points, one of which is it's not that simple for NBC. You need to just put everything on Peacock, because they have a lot of deals with cable providers that would make it complicated. And he also says that, you know, maybe Peacock wouldn't be even able to handle that volume of traffic. So with the situation as it is, definitely the Olympics, in terms of just ratings, old-fashioned Nielsen, watch it on your TV ratings, are much bigger than everything else that it is up against in primetime combined. But still, yes, it has just been a rough ride, and it makes you question everything, including about, you know, we've talked about this before, live sports and the value of live sports and what gets people engaged. So this has been a struggle.
Yeah, and it's not just for the NBC network as well. It's, you know, all of the other cable channels that benefit from the residual interest. It's the Today Show. It's all the other promotional aspects of this that power their fall lineup. All the stuff that we have traditionally associated as being in the halo of Olympics, that is all diminished if the ratings are down 30 to 40%. I mean, there's an entire Olympics industrial complex around this that is going to be harmed.
I will just note that NBC Uni has said they have 50 million signups for Peacock. I do think they'll get some benefit from this. And I mean, look, in Joe Adalian's piece, he contrasted like a Grey's Anatomy rating from May of 2016, which was a 2.1, And you don't need to know what that number means. Just compare it with the Grey's Anatomy rating from May of this year, a 0.9. So it's a challenge for this entire business as the transition is underway. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a founding partner of a new media outlet, and it is called Puck News, and it's launching soon. Coming up after a short break, media mogul Barry Diller says cancel culture in Hollywood has gone too far. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. This week, we're bringing you the second part of our conversation with Barry Diller, who became a legend in the entertainment business in top jobs at ABC, Paramount, and Fox. Producer Scott Rudin has been a longtime Diller associate. He worked briefly as an executive at Fox in the mid-1980s when Diller was chairman of the studio. Diller left Hollywood in 1992 and became a billionaire as the head of IAC. Rudin became an EGOT, one of the few winners of Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. In recent years, Diller and IAC have financed Rudin's movies, including Uncut Gems, Eighth Grade, and Lady Bird. Diller and Rudin have also produced shows on Broadway, To Kill a Mockingbird, Carousel, and the upcoming revival of The Music Man, among them. But following an April cover story in The Hollywood Reporter about allegations of workplace abuse, Rudin has stepped away from The Music Man as well as upcoming film projects. It was hardly news that working for Rudin meant enduring grueling hours and dealing with fits of rage, alleged verbal and, in at least one case, physical assault. That went on for years, but the culture has been changing, and The Hollywood Reporter article put the allegations on the record. In the weeks that followed, more former assistants spoke out in other publications and on this show. Eileen Klumhouse told us she only worked for Rudin for 1 week, and yet...
When he fired me, he said, "You ruin everything you touch."
Max Hoffman made it 9 months before he quit for the sake of his mental health.
We had this like really long conversation for like 45 minutes. Not a conversation, it was more like 45 minutes of him just like digging into me, calling me stupid and stubborn and selfish, saying no one would ever want to work with me again.
And Evan Davis was fired and rehired multiple times.
Finally, he fired me for the last time the day after New Year's Day. And that was it. And it's this very surreal thing where I felt like a little bit of pride that I was finally getting out. But your body also just feels completely drained that you don't really know how to feel any joy from it. It's wartime, you know? When you're there, all you're thinking about is how you survive it.
When I invited Barry Diller on the show, the plan was to get his thoughts on the state of the industry. And you can hear his many insights on last week's podcast. But I also felt I had to ask Diller for his reaction to the Rudin story. To be honest, I didn't expect him to answer at length, but as you'll hear, an unusually emotional Diller had much to say. I want to ask you about a cultural question. I was actually talking to somebody who used to work for you a couple of days ago, Larry Gordon. And he said to me, "I am really glad I'm not in this business so much anymore because my temper is too bad and I would be just decimated by the culture right now. I would not be tolerated." You know, Larry Gordon, he does have a temper on him. He's a producer of many very big movies, and Die Hard and many others. But what do you think? I know you have staunchly defended Scott Rudin, who's been under fire. You know, you were a tough guy in your own right.
I've been very clear. I said, I don't condone extreme behavior in any way. And I don't believe I've ever participated in such behavior. Have I been difficult? Have I been noisy? Have I been always wanting to push for creative conflict, because I think that's a healthy atmosphere for those that enjoy it? Absolutely. But I think there is a difference between that and what we would call abusive, personal abusive behavior. And that, I think is not tolerable. Larry Gordon, you could scream and back and forth with Larry. I mean, to watch Michael Eisner and Larry Gordon, you know, have arguments was joyful because it was just so funny.
No, I'm not suggesting that Larry was actually an abuser in that way. He's just a hot-tempered man.
I think we mix that, and I think there's less tolerance even for, there is less tolerance for what I would call healthy creative conflict than before. That's the culture right now. I think that there is an end result price paid for that. There's also a thing where these businesses, these are tough businesses, and they require tough-minded people to really succeed. I think that's probably true in most things, but it's certainly true in media businesses. And I don't think we should mistake tough-minded, tough acting, hardly not without empathy or not without rationality or loud argument, for being something bad.
Well, having said that, there's a lot of people who have come out and spoken about Scott Rudin, including on this show. You standing your ground? I think you said you hadn't seen it, you didn't believe it.
I've had arguments with Scott. Everybody's had arguments with Scott. How could you not in this business? I never heard him yell at anyone. I never saw him abuse anyone. I was just, somebody just, I think it was in some recent reportage on this, that said I was on a telephone call with Mr. Rudin and his assistant where Mr. Rudin called the police while I listened to get this person, I don't know, whatever. I was on no such call. It never happened. So I can only tell you my own experience.
But you come to the table, Barry, literally with billions of dollars at a time when Scott needs money to finance plays and what people love.
No, I'm just saying, all I'm saying is this.
He's not yelling at you, is my point.
Kim, I've been also involved with Scott on the ground in dozens of films, television things, Broadway things, with lots of people, not just me, people who he didn't have anything like the relationship he needed, quote, to have with me because I was a financier, where he was anything but creatively stimulating, always about the work itself, more about the work itself than almost anyone else I'd ever seen. And I never heard him act inappropriately. That is my experience. And it wasn't just with me. That's all I can speak to. I can't speak to anything else. If in fact it is true that he was abusive to people in his office, I never participated in it. I do not condone it. And if it was true, I would hope that he would find a way, as has been suggested, to deal with that and re-enter the business because he's too valuable a resource to not be in the business unless his behavior in the future would be heinous.
Mm-hmm. So you will continue to work with him.
Right now, excuse me, there is no work with Scott right now.
Yeah, it's a little ambiguous, but yes.
It's not ambiguous, Kim, because I'm involved in it, and it's very clear. He is withdrawn.
But you hope he will return. Do you know anything about what he's doing to try to make this?
No, I don't know, and I hope he finds a path to return, because I think that, again, I don't know. There's been relatively few, there's been noise, but there's been relatively few, the ones we've both read about, relatively meaning in less than 15 or something. I don't know. There have been 6, 8, 4, 9 specifics. If they're true, I hope he finds a way to work through it and come out educated. I don't know that that's true, and I don't have any information about anything else.
Okay. I mean, I don't want the whole interview to go into this. I'll just note that New York Magazine alone had 33 people talking. And so there's a lot. It's a lot.
This is the thing I don't know. 33 people, did they have 33 direct instances of specific behavior? I don't think so.
Well, I think 33 people addressed. Look, this has been Scott's reputation for years and years and years. I mean, it kind of makes me wonder what's going on here because I feel like.
Wait a second. Reputation, I knew of his reputation too for being very difficult in his office and certainly having a lot of controversy with the people he dealt with. Controversy meaning they didn't reach agreement, it came to a bad end, or this or that happened. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, the kind of personal abusive behavior of which relatively few have been cited. If there are more, I just haven't heard them. I do know about the reputation in his office. Everybody knows about that. He is a controversial character, always has been, because he's so much about the work and so invested in it. And it probably has gotten to extremes that are not tolerable. So that's all. I don't know anymore.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Obviously, he worked for you years ago. You know, he is extremely talented. He is extremely, extremely, I think, abusive. But you don't see it firsthand. I mean, you know, like a lot of, there are things that aren't witnessed that turn out to sometimes end up with people facing very dire consequences that aren't necessarily witnessed by the world, right?
That is true. But for that, as in some of these other cases, you know, there was a trial. Harvey Weinstein is in jail.
I'm talking about Harvey. That's what I'm referencing. It's not like people, you know, I've had people tell me they didn't know who worked for him, but they kind of maybe knew. I mean, you know, they didn't witness. He didn't invite everybody in the room to see what he was doing, but he still did it. So I'm just saying, and I guess it raises another question, which is how many do you need and what crosses the line?
Look, my point is only this. Harvey Weinstein went through a trial and was guilty. Now, one presumes a fair trial, et cetera. That is different than allegations made often by people who will not say who they are. Sometimes they do, whatever. But those allegations should be followed up and tested in some arena that is fair. And if, in fact, the verdict is guilty or whatever, good and fine. But often, as we know, that does not happen.
I don't know that conduct has to be criminal to be unacceptable, right? We can agree about
that.
Of course not.
No. I didn't say that. I said what it has to be is examined. Doesn't have to be a criminal thing, but it does have to be.
But in what forum? I mean, he doesn't work for a studio. He's an independent player.
I don't know what forum, to be honest with you. I just don't think. I think due process of some kind is important. I think cancel culture as a generic pervasive, that you are basically canceled on accusation, I think is very dubious and unfortunate. And I just want more due process. And I also think that the death penalty, which is what the analogy is to me in this case, where that happens, you basically can't work, you know, probably ever. That there is proportionality should be part of it. Due process should be part of it. And I think without that, I think it's a bad culture and business.
Well, we've been in a reckoning period, you know, post-Harvey. I will tell you from my own experience, having done a number of these stories, they aren't easy to publish. You know, these guys will get lawyers. I think that I have probably personally been responsible for over $1 million in lawyers getting paid by clients in the last couple of three, four years because they will threaten us. Now, it's not so easy for a public figure to prevail in court, especially in California.
I'm not talking about courts, Kim, and I'm not condoning.
I'm just saying we can't publish without vetting. We can't publish without vetting. And all of the major Time's Up stuff has been done in the media because we don't have a forum.
I'm not talking about what you publish. I'm talking about the consequences of a culture that cancels based upon what is published without due process or sometimes proportionality.
Right.
That's all.
I take your point.
That is the line I'm drawing. Nothing else. I'm not saying that if there's publishable material, go at it. But the consequences of it today, I think it's hard to say, or at least hard for me to accept that without some sort of due process, some follow-up.
Right. And we have no mechanism for that, right? No mechanism to adjudicate.
We don't have a mechanism, but we do have a mechanism for saying, let's deal sometimes with proportionality. Should people receive essentially the death penalty, meaning they simply can't work anymore?
I mean, it depends what they did, I guess is the short answer, right? It depends what they did and how documented it is.
We certainly have the death penalty, and I don't mean this, you know I'm not talking literally, but we certainly know Harvey Weinstein is not working. Again, he's probably not getting out of prison.
Right.
But contrast that with behavior that goes all the way up the extreme to other people we all know who did not do anything, quote, illegal or prosecutable, who can't work because of this or that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a continuum of conduct, and where we are, some of it should be a permanent ban and some of it probably should not, especially if people take stock and figure out how to fix their problems. But we have no mechanism for it. So what happens instead is a sort of a, you could say, oh, well, everybody flees like cowards and from any controversy, or you could say that people just decide what they're willing to be associated with or not.
Yep.
Do you think Scott can make a comeback? You think that talent will work with him and he can come back?
Well, I would look again, unless somebody tells me, or unless facts come out that are over the line, and we all know what a rational line is here.
I don't know that we do, Barry. I don't know that there's consensus on that.
But we would have to agree there is some rational line. Not that there's consensus on it, but there is one. It exists. I'm not stating what it is. I'm saying that depending upon what the facts are, and if they are not, again, house number, over the line, meaning they're not heinous acts, they're not throwing somebody out of a car, moving car.
But that's one of the allegations.
Well, but Scott has said, he said, it never happened. What I did is pull my car over and say, and get out of the car. There is a big difference there. Anyway, but I'm not doing this. All I'm saying is that if that is true, and if he wants to come back, I don't know that he does. And I've not talked to him directly about this, or I wouldn't speak of it at all. But if he wants to, and there is a path, and he explains his history, and it stands up, and all of that, and he explains what's happened, I would hope so.
Barry Diller is chairman and senior executive of IAC. Thank you very much for doing this, Barry. I really appreciate it.
Happy to be talking with you, Kim.
Before we go, Barry Diller's next film project is The Tragedy of Macbeth, directed by Joel Coen and starring Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand. The black and white film, an award season hopeful, was a Scott Rudin production, but his name was taken off the credits in April, long after filming had been completed. The Tragedy of Macbeth is set to open the New York Film Festival in September. So far, Coen and McDormand, longtime Rudin collaborators, have not responded to queries about their association with him, though it's likely they'll be asked about it in connection with this film. In May, former Rudin assistants Evan Davis and Eileen Klumhouse had some thoughts about that.
There's going to come a point where the talent that he works with will give statements, and I feel like a lot of them will be to the effect of, we didn't know, we had no idea that this was going on. And that's just, that is stretching the truth at best. You know, Hollywood doesn't keep secrets, and also you're in that office, you see what goes on.
Even if you call into that office, there's a non-zero chance that you'll hear him screaming in the background. I'm pretty confident.
Absolutely.
I mean, I had been on the phone, and I know that people could hear him yelling in the background because they would comment on it. There's mm-hmm. There's no secrets. Everybody knows.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.